relevant visual cortex.
Yeah, so ladies and gentlemen, the central question in neural information processing is how does the cortex learn, and how is information represented in the cortex? And more precisely, in the visual cortex, which is that we learned last week, which is located here, these questions would be: how does the visual cortex learn to see and to recognize? And how is this visual information represented in the cortex? And so in this talk, we would like to give you, try to give some answers on the question how the neural circuitry is formed by which the cortex processes the early stages of vision. Early stages, that means in the primary visual cortex, so the first areas that the information gets into. The higher areas are, of course, less studied, less well studied, and are more complicated. This work would not have been possible without Fred Wolf, whose profound knowledge of neurobiology was instrumental for this work over the years. And well, we have these institutes, but it's going to change its name. Let me mention a few of our collaborators on these things. I actually want to show that there's a lot of pattern formation and nonlinear dynamics involved in this question of how the brain learns to see. And we will be dealing with so-called neural maps and their formation. And there are various kinds of maps, which I have seen already and which I will show again. The people involved in this work in earlier years are mentioned here. I will touch upon this work partly. It's Klaus Pawelczyk, who's got his own group now in Bremen, Hans-Ulrich Bauer, Frank Hofstimmer, Olaf Scherf, who left, unfortunately, especially this one person, left for industry or business. And our experimental collaborators were, mostly in the group of Wolf Singer in Frankfurt, Sigrid Löwel, meanwhile at UCSF, and Tobias Bonhoeffer, who's now at the MPE for neurobiology. And we still have a very fruitful ongoing collaboration with Sigrid Löwel. Well, as I said, this talk will deal with how information is represented in the cortex. And this will be in the form of so-called, what is called neural maps. And then we have to ask how are these maps formed. So let me first show you a few examples of these neural maps. The most simple to understand is the somatosensory map. It's simply a map from the surface of your body to the somatosensory cortex. So when you stimulate a certain location on the surface of your body, this is information is transmitted, and the spatial information is represented spatially in the cortex. This is a cross-section, a rough cross-section across the somatosensory cortex. And what's plotted here are the parts of the body that are sensitive for a certain neuron. So here, if you stimulate the index, you will get a signal mainly here in this point, and the little finger will excite this neuron, and so on. So that's a simple kind of map. As you can easily see, various parts of the body take up more or less space in the brain, like the hands take much more space than the feet, and you could ask why is it so? But this also means a different magnification factor for this part. So the lips also have a different magnification factor from the feet. And if you plot this in the following way, oops, sorry, this was backwards, you would get such a representation of yourself in your brain. A robot? Homunculus. Homunculus. It's actually known as the homunculus. Yeah, goes under this. Homunculus. Dr. Faust. But shouldn't we close the windows? I don't know. Yeah, it's fine. Okay. Yeah. Very good. If you're fine. So here we'll deal with visual maps, and so let me shortly recall the visual system. The image that falls on the retina is transmitted through some optical tract via some relay station, the corpus cuniculatum laterale, to the primary visual cortex, and seen from the top, looks like this. The left visual field falls on the right part of the retina and vice versa. And so these two parts are transmitted to the visual cortex. But what you see here is that this splits up. And so the right part goes to the right hemisphere and the left part goes to the left hemisphere, which means that the left visual field is represented in the right hemisphere and the right visual field in the left hemisphere, as many other things also. But what is important here is to note that both eyes are mapped to both hemispheres. So the left hemisphere gets input from the left and the right eye. And a neuron can use this input from both eyes or specialize on a single eye. This is good. This question is answered in the next paragraph. Well, it doesn't. It doesn't. I mean, there is a lot of, as we learned last week, there's a lot of processing in the retina already. And this was actually one of the remarks Jacquard made against another remark. But of course, there's not only processing in the retina, otherwise you wouldn't need our brain. Here's such a map. This answers your question very roughly so far, but it does it. So here you see in a piece of the primary visual cortex, about, I don't know, 2-3 millimeters in size, and colored in black and white are those neurons that receive input from the left or the right eye respectively. Or in gray if they are activated by both eyes. So if they are sensitive to both input from both eyes. And we'll see other maps that are more precise than this soon. And here's another map that will.
So this is in one, on one side of the grid?
Yes.
And then there's a corresponding one on the other side.
Exactly.
And if the answer to his question that there's nothing much white and black, I mean, you could analyze.
And there is gray, yes.
And then there's gray, which is 50-50, I mean, on average.
Mm-hmm.
It depends.
Let me answer this question in the very end of the of the talk, because this question has been posed experimentally. Oh yeah, left hemisphere and right hemisphere. Oh well, I don't know, but in principle it's half and half, and so even people who are blind in one part of the visual field, and so who just. If you see a bicyclist passing by, you don't they wouldn't see it on one side. And
the view is that it's white now. When you see there, it's just white. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, it's.
Well, the white is from the right eye, and the left eye.
Well, it's rather. Actually, I don't know which way around, but it's the input from one eye, and it's. So it is gray if it gets input from both eyes, and it's dark if it doesn't get input from the other eye, or vice versa. I guess the dark is the activity. So this is an autoradiography, so I don't know whether it's a negative or the positive, black and white. White is activity, and there is a symmetry. Yeah, you want to go back? So these measurements have been taken by autoradiographic models methods, where you use radioactive tracers to that settle in the cortex, and put the brain into slices afterwards and put it onto a film and develop it and so on. And there are better methods available meanwhile, but let me mention this also. This is the analog of the somatosensory map for the visual system. It shows how the image in the retina, or half retina shown here, is mapped into the primary visual cortex, and here you see a coordinate system, and here you see the image of this coordinate system. This is actually how we started in this field, and it was maybe I'll mention this afterwards, with the diploma thesis of Fred, when we asked how these retinotopic maps are formed. But I wanted to talk about some more recent work. Okay, now. Of what? Of this here, or? Yeah, well, this is a half retina, as you can see, the visual field. And so it's all of the visual fields, essentially, that is shown here. And, okay, you ask, never mind, I'll come to this later. So, of course, if we had been limited to this type of experimental results, we wouldn't have made much progress. in the mid-80s, the late 80s, new methods were developed to study such maps accurately and with high precision, and especially high spatial resolution in vivo, in the living animals. And they go under the name of optical imaging and voltage-sensitive dyes and so on. And so let me show you these methods. This is actually without any dye. It's a method that has been developed by Grinwald. And it utilizes the fact that the oxygenized and deoxygenized hemoglobin have a different absorption spectrum in the red, in the visual red. And but very tiny differences. And by analyzing these differences, one can get a map of the activity in the brain. So here's the animal that looks to a screen. Typically, it sees in these experiments, it sees a moving stripe pattern on a certain angle. And well, here's a CCD camera. Here's a illuminator CCD camera and some electronics, and of course a computer which analyzes this and averages over many of these simulations, and then the display that gives you the pattern. So as I said, this came up in the late 80s, and the experiments. Well, this was, I think it was after fMRI. Yeah, well, this has a much higher resolution than fMRI. They're just, people are just beginning to get into this. Yeah. And you wouldn't like, sure, you wouldn't like to do these experiments on humans, at least except in exceptional situations. And so with fMRI, you could do this on humans, but until recently, the resolution was too bad still. But there are, I mean, you have in Göttingen, we have this friend of ours, Jens Fram, who made a lot of money for the Max Planck Society by his patent for magnetic resonance imaging. And he's just reaching this scale where he can analyze maps. OK, but of course, those methods were very important for studying this question of pattern formation in the brain. And we were very fortunate to be in Frankfurt at this time, when I started in Frankfurt in 1989, and we built up this group. We were in very close contact with people at the Max Planck Institute, Wolf Singer, Max Planck Institute for Brain Research, where Bonhoeffer, who came back from this group of Grinwald, built up such a lab for optical imaging. And so we got, we had access to these new experimental results very early. And we could, since they were also in our Sonderforschungsbereich, some Center for Nonlinear Dynamics, we could closely collaborate with these people. And I think this was very important for this work. Now let me show you some results that have been obtained with this method. And I will illustrate this with a movie where we use data by White and Coppola from V1 of the ferret. And this movie has reanimated these experimental data. So what you see is not what you would see in a real experiment, but so the motion that you get, you will see, is a reanimation. And I actually have to point out before I start the movie, I have to point out once. No, I will stop it. So here's a visual stimulus that's shown to the animal, a grating that moves under a certain angle, and we'll see the neuronal activity in the primary visual cortex here. Oops, sorry. Yes, I need the mouse here. Okay, here you see the activity in black. Stop it again. So, whoops. Okay, I go back. So what you saw was a pattern of activity, and you should not misunderstand this pattern as the image of this pattern. So what you see here is not an image of this pattern, like the retinotopic map. It rather shows those areas in the cortex that respond to this orientation of these stripes. If we choose another orientation, we get a different pattern. Okay, so I'll start it again. Okay, do this. When the motion stops, the activity stops also. Now we move it again, we get the same pattern. Now we use a different orientation, and you see that different areas respond. And now if we use all orientations, then you see that how these... what about what?
Velocity
of motion. Yeah, has this been studied, Fred?
As you change the velocity, it will take out some region of velocity. And that's different in different areas. What's going to be different?
Okay, now when you look at this here, actually here I could stop it. Now let's look just around this particular spot, and you will see that there is a singularity. The activity goes around a circle as you go around pi, the orientation. And now we color these neurons in different colors depending on whether they respond to horizontal or vertical or so orientations. Okay, so this is... This is all reconstructed. You wouldn't do such an experiment. I mean, you could do this experiment, but the real experiment that had is underlying this animation here has only motions like this here. It doesn't rotate. This is just as an illustration, and sometimes these illustrations are misleading. For instance, recently I understood that people... Recently I understood that one can actually misunderstand these patterns by thinking that they are the image of this pattern. But I already pointed out to you that you shouldn't understand it like that. Okay, now we looked at this area here. No, at this one here. And let's look at this more closely. You see that there are all colors represented here as you go around a circle around this point, so it's a singularity. And here there's one with the opposite direction, opposite sense. And so you could describe this by charges plus 1/2, minus 1/2 or so. And there are, of course, phase singularities, but in the neurobiological literature, they were introduced as pinwheels by Bonhoeffer and Grinwald, who found these in these maps in, I guess, in 1991, it was published. Well, Fred Wolfke will give a talk next week on these pinwheels, in particular their densities in the visual cortex. And so I will exclude this here from our talk today. And Fred Wolf will also deal with a somewhat different model, the that relies only on symmetry properties, and which has actually been advertised last week already as the Wolf model. And so today will be more down to earth and study a somewhat more concrete and explicit model. Let me call it the Little Red Riding Hood model. So, and I'll show this after. Now, those are the maps, and you could ask, how are these formed? Is the animal born with these maps, or are they formed in the course of lifetime during development? And if yes, what are the mechanisms for this formation? And can you explain the properties of these maps? And let me show you some more experimental results that give us some clues on this question. That's a good question, and this is what we want to answer afterwards. To a large extent, yes. Well, you have to still ask within one species or not. So to a large extent, yes. To some extent, no. Actually, I come to this in a minute. Maybe I should mention this here, this retinotopy. This was a very early stage of our work when we started to study the formation of these retinotopic maps. And so what you see in cat visual cortex and in the area 18 and 19, which is extended, let me draw it like this here. And you have such a half retina. And you map this to such a visual area. Then, actually, I should plot it in some other way. I should plot the backward map. What one finds is the following, experimentally. If you put a grid into this area, and you plot the points, the image, the backward image of this grid into the retina, then what one sees is that there are some indentations here, some a fold actually. This is actually already the interpretation of ours. But one finds what is called field discontinuities. I give you the explanation first and then the phenomenon. So when you go along a path here in the retina that crosses this fold, one has the map is discontinuous, right? Because you go from here to here, which is some distance here to here, right? So you jump as you go from here to here. You make a jump from here to here. In the forward map. What I showed here is the backward map. You should imagine these points of the grid that accumulate here. So there are discontinuities in these maps. And one can ask Do you find these in all animals? No. Not even in all areas of cat visual cortex. Area 17 doesn't have these discontinuities. Area 18 and 19 do. And in cat, other animals don't have them at all. And then there are cat who have one, and there are cat who have two or three. They are known as islands because people were used to look at the forward image, not at the backward image. So the answer to your question is there is a variability, but within a species, cat, essentially all animals have this discontinuity, but some have two or three and one or only one. No. No, they may be, their location is varied. Not in time. Yeah. In time. Yeah.
For a particular animal, the variety sometimes during development.
Yeah. It's saved. Yeah. So that's a different kind of map, which I'll. Didn't want to treat here, but we actually studied this with very similar techniques as what I will show you. Up to then, people had only asked, tried to fit these maps. They have been measured, but computational neuroscientists have fitted these, but they hadn't asked where do they come from? Why are they the way they are? So let me go forward. So this gives us some hint on the way in which maps are formed. This is now again the orientation preference of a ferret. The ferret opens its eyes around day 35 after birth, and what you see is for different orientations of a contour, different angles, that day 34 you cannot detect such an orientation preference map. Day 38 you can detect it, and it forms somewhere after the eye opening. So this gives us a hint that the activity of visual activity is relevant for the formation of these maps and this visual experience. Now this is an answer on your question, and actually for us it was a question, still pose the question. It shows ocular dominance maps and orientation preference maps for different species, here for cat and here for monkeys. And what you see is for monkeys, this map is stripe-like, and the orientation preference map is patch-like, and it has a larger typical wavelength for the ocular dominance than for the orientation preference. And for cats, it is just the opposite. It is stripe-like for your orientation preference and patch-like for the ocular dominance. And also here, the wavelength, the characteristic wavelength is larger than here. And now this answers part of your question. If I say that these maps typically are like this in cat and typically like this in monkeys, and doesn't depend so much on the individual that you study. Of course, details of the map depend on the individual, as they depend on visual experience. And one can, there are experiments that I could mention where cat have been raised with squinting, with cross-eyed vision. So by cutting a muscle, they a cross-eyed vision was induced early when they opened up their eyes. And so they had a different visual experience. And also these maps look different, but there might have been some genetic influence in these studies. So the results are no longer certain nowadays, and I didn't want to mention these. Okay, so here are these maps, and we can ask, oh, well, these are the very early experiments that have been made in the 60s already on deprived animals that were raised only in horizontal stripes or vertical striped environment, or one eye closed or so. And then when they got later into a normal environment, they tumbled. They were not able to orient themselves. But this is, say, the rough type of experiments on vision. Okay, so let me ask these following questions. We have these different patterns that are similar within each species, but different from one species to the other. Are there general principles which can explain these differences? And can we explain the formation of these maps and these differences from some very general theory? And the answer is yes, otherwise I wouldn't ask this question. But before I go on, let me show you a last experimental result, which is already somewhat old. This shows the representation of a hand in the somatosensory cortex of a monkey. And here you see the representation of the five fingers. And this monkey underwent surgery, an adult monkey actually, and it lost its third finger under surgery. And after a while, this somatosensory map was measured again, and you could see that the area that was taken up in cortex by the third finger was enacted by the second and fourth finger. So this hints to some
touch.
Yes, touch. Yeah. So this is some indication of competition about cortical territory. So if you wish, these neurons here compete about the territory in the cortex, and it well. Okay, now let me come to the dynamics, or first to the mathematical description of these maps. We describe these patterns by order parameters, for instance, the orientation preference map, by a complex variable z, where x is the location of the neuron in the cortex. The phase here, theta, is the orientation of the preferred angle, of the preferred orientation, at this cortical neuron x. And the absolute value z of x is the susceptibility at this point, so it gives the selectivity of this neuron. The ocular dominance map is simpler, so we describe this by a scalar field O of x, so it is larger than zero when the neuron at x responds to the left eye, and smaller than zero if it responds to the right eye, and it can also be zero, of course. And our maps are maps from a position in the cortex to feature space. These are, of course, backward maps, inverse maps, to feature space consisting of this complex Z and the O. And development of the animal is the dynamics of these maps. And you'll see that you have to study these simultaneously. So one can ask, what is the dynamics of these, how are these maps learned? And a lot is known about microscopic mechanisms, but there's no direct connection between the microscopic world so far and the macroscopic world. So much of what we know nowadays is based on an old suggestion by Hebb. 50 years ago, the Hebbian learning. Let me first show you this. You have the retina, you have the neurons will be represented by positions R in the retina, and we have activity profiles. The stimulus consists of profiles A of R in the retina. And then in the cortex, this results in some excitation E of X that is due to many connections, the total result of many connections that go from here to here, and also lateral connections or horizontal connections within the visual cortex. So this is the E of X, and we have cortical neurons denoted by X, some position X. And then the synaptic strength, the synaptic coupling between individual neurons at R here and at X here will be denoted by W of R and X. Oh, well, theta is not here. I'll come to this. So this is just...
Before you had C,
I'll come.
Is this a new notation for what you had before or something a little different?
This Z will be a simplification of what I show now. So now you can ask, this is mediated by their wiring, of course, from retinal neurons to cortical neurons. And you can ask how learning, of course, consists in the modification of these synaptic weights, of these synaptic couplings. And then you can ask how are these weights modified. And much of what we know is based on more or less phenomenological models that are based on the Hebbian suggestion. So these theories are successful, and they indicate that there is something, some truth in this thing. And there is, of course, microscopic work on LTP and LDP, long-term potentiation and depression. But there is still not a very clear relation between the two worlds. So Hebb has suggested the following, and if you wish, this is some kind of Darwinism, neuronal Darwinism, it's competitive Hebbian plasticity. So he suggested that the weights between two neurons are increased, the weight is increased, if they are simultaneously active. So W is increased by delta W, given by some epsilon times A of R and E of X. Of course, this would lead to an explosion of these weights, and they need to be normalized, or the norm needs to be conserved. So one needs some decay term, which is shown here, minus W E of X. And this decay term guarantees the normalization of these weights. And as I said, this is some competition on for cortical territory. For the activity profile in the cortex, we make a simplifying assumption, assume a Gaussian. At some maximum X star, which need not be this particular X, depending on the activation A of R and many other things in the retina, will have a location of maximum excitation in the cortex. I'll come to this later. Well, not yet.
That is a map.
We have. I will specify.
The cortex star is a map.
Yes. But I will specify. It still needs some specification of this E of X, which I will do later. Okay. And now, learning. The learning is an approach to a stationary state under this dynamics. And let me specify this a little more. Now we have a left eye and a right eye, and we have activation in the left A of R in the left and in the right eye, and both eyes are coupled to the same part of the visual cortex, to neurons at X, and we have excitation profile E of X. Let me introduce, to get to your question, what is the map, some coarse-grained variables or some features. E of X can be some spontaneous activity, but can also be the response of the cortex to some A of R, which is mediated, let me perhaps finish my sentence, which is mediated by the direct connections that I've shown here, R to X, but also by indirect connections from R prime to X prime and connections from X prime to X. Oh, well, you can integrate and get the normalization of these W's. You can easily show by assuming this E of X times W of R and X, that the norm is conserved. But let me go on to this. I'm getting a little late. Now let me come, maybe you can clear this. Well, I guess I should go on because otherwise I don't get to the meat. Now to answer your question, how do we get to these maps? Let us introduce these variables SO and O of X. The ocular dominance feature and the ocularity of the stimulus. This is simply it's the integral over A of AL minus AR, and tells you the extent to which the stimulus is centered in the left eye. And O of X is the integral over the W's, WL minus WR, over the retina, and it tells you the extent to which this cortical neuron X is selective for the left eye, integrated over the whole retina, left minus right eye. So that's what is called a feature, and this is why we're talking about feature maps. If we are dealing with maps WRX, this would be high-dimensional maps. One can do this, and we have done this in one of these works. Maybe I should mention this afterwards. But let me first continue with this type of map. So then the Hebbian learning in terms of the O of X variable looks like this here. Of course, the modification delta W leads to the modification delta O, and it's just the difference and the integral. And when you sort out the terms, then you get one term like this here, using the Hebbian learning rule that I mentioned before. You get this here, and you see that this integral in blue is the same as this here. So this is the ocularity of the stimulus, tells you, well, SO. And this integral here is the ocular dominance of the cortical neuron X, so O of X. And so then we end up with a dynamical rule that is determined by the SO minus OX times E of X. And this looks very simple. And it replaces then these high-dimensional maps by what is called a feature map, a self-organizing feature map. And of course, I should mention that E of X still depends on the stimulus. We have still not determined what is the winner neuron, the X star, where you have the maximum excitation. And now we'll make some simplifying assumption to get to some closed dynamics for the O of X and, of course, the nonlinearity. And first, let me introduce these notions here. Perhaps first, the receptive field centers. A receptive field of them, forget about the star here, the receptive field of a neuron at X is the set of all neurons in the retina from which this one gets input. And the receptive field center is its center, the center of the set. And this can, of course, be generalized in more abstract forms. You can have a receptive field in ocularity or in orientation preference or many other things. People still talk about receptive fields. And so this is the center of mass of these connections that go from the X to somewhere in the retina, integrated over the retina. That's called a receptive field center. S of R is also a center of mass, but it's the center of mass of the stimulus, right? A of R, added up left and right arm. And so this is the retinotopic map, which tells you, or it's a feature map for the retinotopic map. It tells you, well, from which position R in the retina, you get input to the position X in the visual cortex. Another feature, a coarse-grained feature map. Why do I say coarse-grained? It's because in simulations, you use some lattice, some coarse-graining of these neurons, of course. So again, here's the dynamics. And we assume that the learning takes place under fast, randomly changing stimuli that are represented, say, by their features. Only the SR, the center of excitation in the retina, and the SO, the center of, well, the ocularity feature. And this is an average over these random stimuli. And this gives us some kind of differential equation or something more complicated. And then there is the E of X, which still depends on the X, and we have to make some assumption on this. And this is here. The HAP rule is not a single rule. It's some competitive learning rule, but you can formulate this in different ways and it will give you different models, although the outcome of these models can be very similar. Since we are only interested in the stationary state, right, and how it approaches the stationary state is anyhow is something that we cannot measure so easily. So, yes. Yeah. The retinotopy is assumed to be homogeneous here. Identity, R of X. No. is especially homogeneous map. Yeah. We represent this by what I said, a feature map by R and X. So map from some center in the retina R to some neuron X. Yes. Now, so in order to end the definition of this model, here's the closure of the dynamics. We assume that the maximum excitation at X star is determined by some minimum condition. And this is, let me say it in words, the cortical neuron X star that represents best the stimulus, the particular momentary stimulus. Since you minimize the distance between the stimulus center SR in the retina and the receptive field center from some cortical neuron X. So X star is the cortical neuron that represents best the stimulus, whose receptive field center is closest to the stimulus. And the same for the ocularity variable. Okay, so this is the closure of the dynamics. And it's a hard competition. It's a winner-take-all algorithm. There are other algorithms, but maybe I should come to this at a later point. Okay, so here we get the nonlinear dynamics, and we can ask, we can study the stability analysis. There's a symmetry left and right eye. So O of X equals 0 is a stationary solution. But is it a stable stationary solution? Now we can linearize this dynamics that I showed before, get some linear operator, and it's an integral differential equation. This linear in O of X and a coupling to neighboring cortical neurons mediated by this convolution and the Laplacian here. And now, of course, I guess I don't have to tell you about this here. You just learned it last week. You make an ansatz, a mode ansatz, and the growth rates are determined by these eigenvalues lambda of k that are shown here. And it's actually like a GUE function distribution. So it's this Gaussian times k squared and has a hump. At some finite wave number k, this wave number k comes out as inversely proportional to sigma, and sigma was the width of the horizontal couplings in the cortex. And now the typical wavelength is the inverse of this here, so the typical wavelength that becomes unstable is proportional to the coupling with sigma. And as you increase, as you decrease your sigma, where is it? Okay, now here, sorry. There's a threshold which is given by the variance of these fluctuations, the ocularity fluctuations. And if sigma is larger than this critical sigma, you get the homogeneous state. If it's smaller, you find an instability, and some pattern is formed where we expect a typical wavelength given by this lambda proportional to sigma. So this is, did I mention this? No, let me I guess I jump over this. But let me mention different models now. One can, as I said, one can formulate various types of Hebbian learning. And another possibility is to study the so-called elastic net. It has such an activity blob, like we have the E of X here, not in the cortex, but in the retina. And it has some soft competition between the neurons, in contrast to this winner-take-all algorithm. So the soft, that's called the elastic net. We've also studied a more general model, which is a convolution model, and which contains these two models as limiting cases. We call it the convolution model, and it has these. It interpolates between the elastic net and the winner-take-all models. And one can also study high-dimensional models where you just look at the couplings W of R and X, not at these feature maps in O in terms of O and R of X and so on, but at these directly at these couplings W of R and X. And this is, of course, a very high-dimensional problem because you take into account the entire stimulus, some profile of activation, A of R, and you do not represent it by just its center of mass. So this makes it in a very time-consuming simulation. And all these models in which actually on these high-dimensional, I forgot to mention this, on these high-dimensional models, also Dirk Brockmann was involved, and Maximilian Riesenhuber, as an undergraduate student, the son of our former Minister of Science and Technology in Germany. Although at the time when his son was in our group, he was already no longer Minister of Science and Technology. And he just moved, as we learned this month, from AI at MIT to start his own group at Georgetown University. Okay. But in all these models, these conditions, which are different realizations of Hebbian learning, the outcome for the stationary state was qualitatively the same. So the selected wavelength was proportional to the activation of the width of this coupling. The threshold was determined by the variance of the stimulus. And now I'd like to come to this, to explain these different results here for monkey and cat, these typical differences between ocular dominance and orientation preference pattern maps. We have to generalize this learning approach in order to consider interactions between the map formation for the two types of maps, actually three types of maps. Well, this is what I showed before. It's the ocular dominance dynamics. And we now need a couple dynamics. And you will believe me that for the orientation preference map, you get a similar description, where you replace just the stimulus SO by SZ and O of X by Z of X and so on. And the minimum condition to find the winner neuron X star now needs to include also the stimulus in the orientation preference and Z of X. And this now couples, of course, this minimum condition couples these three features. So what is new now, if we study coupled maps, is we also have the orientation of stimuli as Z, and we have this coupling, and we'll get two critical values, two thresholds, sigma star for the ocular dominance and sigma star for the orientation preference. given, determined each by the variances of these stimuli. And in general, they need not be the same. So we get two different thresholds. And a threshold can be large or a threshold can be small. Now, we've suggested a sequential bifurcation scenario that is based on empirical knowledge that these couplings, horizontal couplings in the cortex, decrease in the course of lifetime, even early lifetime. So these sigmas, the width of these horizontal couplings, decrease monotonously in time. And if we have a large threshold, we'll cross an instability early in time. If you have a smaller threshold, we will cross the instability larger, a larger point in time. And correspondingly, if sigma star is large, we have this early bifurcation gives us a large wavelength, since the preferred wavelength is proportional to sigma star. And here we'll get a smaller wavelength, since it is proportional to sigma star. And from this here, we would observe that the patterns would have to emerge in the order of the wavelength. And here's this applied to cats and monkeys. So assume that you have an ocular dominance threshold smaller than the orientation preference that's shown here. So the animal would first reach this red threshold, the ocular orientation preference threshold, and later the ocular dominance threshold. So then first you would form this orientation preference, and the lambda, which is proportional to the sigma, for the orientation preference will be larger than for the ocular dominance. And this is a cat-like scenario. This is what is observed in cat. Here you see the measurements for seven different individuals. Although, and it's also an answer to your question, although this cat here has the triangle almost smaller than this cat has its square, in all cases, the triangles are at a larger wavelength than the squares. And here's the opposite scenario. If the orientation preference threshold is smaller than the ocular dominance, then you first reach the ocular dominance instability and get a higher wavelength for the ocular dominance and a smaller wavelength for the orientation preference, which is the case for monkeys. So here again, you see that the tendency is to have larger ocular dominance wavelength than orientation preference. Of course, you pick an image for illustration that illustrates best your. Yeah, but nevertheless, they are experimental results. Okay. Oh, now I have to tell you a little bit about the simulations. This was linear stability analysis, and the linear stability analysis already explains us, well, these experimental results in some very general way. Of course, it's based on a hypothesis, and if this theory holds true, we make a prediction. which can be verified experimentally, but has not been verified so far. That is, if our theory holds true, it should also be associated with an earlier formation of these maps. So the orientation preference map should form earlier in cat than the ocular dominance map, earlier in lifetime. So this is a verifiable prediction. It needs to be verified. Now, I didn't mention how you simulate these things. What I showed you, this competitive Hapian learning, winner-take-all algorithm, is also, if you formulate it as an algorithm, and some people nowadays like to formulate theories by algorithms, which I presume you don't have a preference for, but so if you define this by an algorithm, then you would have the so-called Kohonen algorithm for this winner-take-all. What you would do is, and this is what we used for the detailed simulations. What you would do here is you have some stimulus in the retina, which is actually represented by an R of X only. And you have some excitation here. And you would now pick, and you have a maximum excitation at X star. And now in this activity profile here, you have various X's. And all these X's have receptive field centers. And all these receptive field centers, R of all these X's, would be shifted towards the stimulus. Okay, so this is the algorithm that goes with it, but I prefer to formulate this in terms of a kind of stochastic differential equation or so, which is certainly easier to understand than an algorithm, at least to me. Okay, and here are the simulations, which include, of course, the non-linearities, non-linear dynamics. For a monkey-like situation and the coupled development of these maps, what you see here, there's first an ocular dominance instability and then an orientation preference instability. And you see that the ocular dominance map forms first, and afterwards the orientation preference map. And this is stripe-like, this is rather patch-like. And the wavelength here is typically larger than the typical wavelength here. And this simulation in the opposite cat-like situation is you have first the formation of the orientation preference and then a formation of the ocular dominance. And again, here you find stripes and here you find patches. And okay, now here's something that you can open.
So, how do you clear from the analysis that one of the maps has to be patch like and the other one is?
Not yet. This is a good question because it anticipates my our next transparency here. You could. 5 minutes is good. So what we can do in this computer experiments is what one cannot do in real experiment. So computer experiments not only save lives of animals but also can be helpful for experiments that you cannot do on animals. you can cut the interaction between the two types of map formations. And what you see here is a cat-like situation with an ocular dominance map that has formed second in cat. And it's almost in the stationary state already. And then we continue simulating, evolving this ocular dominance map in coupling with orientation preference map and without coupling. And what you see here, if you cut the couplings at a late for an adult animal, this patch-like pattern can reorient itself into a stripe-like pattern. Whereas if you continue simulating, including the interaction, then it will not change much and it will remain patch-like. So this tells us that it's the interaction that determines the patch-like pattern, and it's because it's formed second that it cannot, it has to adapt to what is left already by the orientation preference map.
All of this interaction.
First surf, first go.
The non-material.
Yeah. Maybe we were lucky enough to pick the right model. But it's also, I mean, this Hebbian hypothesis is very old and it's assumed by many people. So and has been successful in other contexts.
Really,
so it's, yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Let's come to this. Yeah, let's come to this later. So, of course, obviously there is some interaction between these two maps, and they look at each other. Or let's say the second one has to look at the first one. And what you see here is that they tend to organize perpendicularly. So the borders of these domains. And here's what comes out of the model, a histogram of these intersection angles between the two maps. And here's the experiment, and the histograms are very similar. A further confirmation of that we've luckily chosen the right model. Maybe I should skip this here. It actually gives the answer. No, let me see what I've got. I think it's almost the end. Gives the answer to a question that has been posed in the very beginning by Gunter Ahlers. If you have a different experience on the different eyes, so here's time, and here's the eye opening, and you can raise a cat which has only one eye open, and you close the other one, suing it. It's called a reverse suture experiment. And then at postnatal day 34, you do the opposite, and you open the other eye and close the first one. So the two eyes have entirely different visual experience. And the question is, do they have the same maps, or do they have different maps? From what I told you, would think they have the different maps. And the answer is yes and no. So what Goldegger and Bonhoeffer have published was, well, here you see this type of map. Let me go on. And here you get, for the other eye, you get this type of map in area 17, 18? Oh, sure. This is area 18. And you see that area 18 is this, 18 and 19 are extended, have a large aspect ratio, and 17 is compact. So that will be essential. So what you see here is they have a very similar pattern, and you look at these pinwheels here, they are almost same location, and so on. So although this these eyes had different experience, the map looks the same. And then these people concluded there must be some innate pre-specification or predetermination of these maps, and to which we opposed in a comment. And it's actually like really binar. This is the answer to the question. Depends on the confinement also. So if you consider area 18, as I said, it's long and elongated. And the typical wavelength that you can select is of the order of the of this length here, L. And here the typical wavelength is small compared to this length, L.
Well, that's a short length.
And yeah, it's a short length, yes. Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. Okay, yes, the short length. And so you have a lot of surface effects. You know this from period doubling in Rayleigh-Binard. where you get only two rolls in small chambers. So here, if you simulate this, Fred sent me this last night by email. So these are simulations, right? Okay. So if you simulate this, well, this was our comment. You see that here you get very similar maps if you take some extended area for different experience. It tells us that the boundary plays a role. And here, when you have such a compact area, L bigger than lambda, then you can get very different patterns. So also this model confirms and explains this type of experiment.
There's another question, how different is the experience?
Yeah, sure.
What, you know, 30 days, and then the next 30 days, what aspect of the experience is really laying this down?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and even experience is partly determined by anatomy, because different animals have a different concentration of ganglia cells, retinal cells in the retina. Some are very peaked. I think it was mentioned last week already by Chacon. Some have a very peaked distribution, and others have, like we and primates, have a we have a peaked distribution, and others have a homogeneous distribution. Well, I answer with another question. Why don't you ask your question in the discussion afterwards? because I'm, in the end, well, there are discrete instability-like events in visual development, and the instabilities are controlled, apparently, by the intrinsic size sigma of horizontal couplings, which were simply approximated by Gaussians, so, well, and the experience stimuli and their variance, the observed wavelength and the patterns can be explained as by the sequential bifurcation scenario and the interaction between the patterns. And the prediction is these patterns, according to this type of theory, must emerge in the order of their wavelength. And that was it.